Shall we make a start in the top last five? I don't know whether there are people who you know who are expecting to be here and haven't arrived yet. But let's make a start. Nice to see you all again on such a hot day. And it's good that there's aircon in this lecture hall. Let me begin in the same way as I did yesterday by introducing another of my amazing colleagues, Gareth Hayson, who works with me in the ACC and is a colleague of Jane's. Gareth joined us 2 years ago after is currently doing his PhD on the urban food system and the associated sustainability challenges and opportunities, and those are themes that we'll be developing this afternoon. Prior to working in the sustainability field as an academic, Gareth spent 15 years working in the hospitality industry, hence the smile on his face always. And he managed a number of businesses there, always working with an eye to transitioning businesses onto a more sustainable footing. So he's deeply immersed in and committed to the principle of sustainability. Back in tertiary study, after that long break, he clearly earned a lot of money. He completed a master's degree in sustainable development, management and planning at Stellenbosch University. And there, they elevated him to a research fellow in the Sustainability Institute. For 5 years working there, he led the sustainable agriculture specialization within the sustainable development postgraduate degree. Biodynamic agriculture and permaculture are key foci in those degree programs. And it's amazing for me to think as an urbanist that we've got someone with that kind of biological, botanical insight. He's been active in a number of other research projects, working with the Development Bank of South Africa on their Development of Sustainable Communities program. He has led the program to develop South Africa's first town-based food strategy, also in Stellenbosch. So he's got that link and knowledge of how local government works. And he's conducted research into the viability, reach, and impact of the Philippi horticultural area that Jane was talking to us about yesterday. He's worked elsewhere in the Global South, not only in Stellenbosch, and his work's taken him, among other places, to Mozambique. And he's also worked in collaboration with Indian partners on sustainable production transitions in Maharashtra state in India. In addition to this very diverse work, Gareth has lectured on health and sustainability to third and fourth year medical students at Tigerberg. And what's left of his diary time, he's channeled into supervising students, postgraduate students, writing books and journal articles, and contributing commentary to the print and radio media. Rated wide still, he has an educational hat on, and he assists with the FET education program, Learning Sustainability, and provides training in that between school and university. Gareth is shortly to leave for Kingston University in Canada on a semester scholarship, and just before he goes, he's decided to give a few more minutes of his time to us. I'm looking forward immensely to hearing what he's going to say, and please would you welcome him.
Thanks, Gordon. I think it's always, when you hear of someone describing what you've done, you get a bit intimidated by yourself, as Jane said. So what I'd like to try and do is speak to the sustainability challenge and the urban challenge and the food challenge and try and find ways that they might interconnect and sometimes conflict with one another. And for me, I would like to argue that this challenge is something that presents a whole set of opportunities. So whilst I might begin by depressing everyone and sort of getting to a point where we might want to crawl into a hole, I think some of those challenges that we face present significant opportunities. And the work that I try to do is try to understand how that transition might take place and what that might be. And so really what I would like to start off with by telling Jane, and not to say that there's anything wrong with the green agenda, but just to try and broaden the discussion of sustainability and what that might be, and try to ground it in a more developing world context, and try to speak to some of the South African challenges and those that we might face in the broader Southern African region. And then speak a little bit about the drivers of unsustainability within the urban food challenge and how some of these responses to the food security challenge have evolved and what those might be and sometimes question some of those as well, and then to try and ground it in a little bit of understanding and add some meat to it, we'll talk to three case studies. I'll speak to two of them, and Jane will help me speak to one of them, particularly around waste and some of those aspects. So,
really,
often the notion of sustainability is described as trying to manage the triple bottom line, and this notion of the triple bottom line, and this is from my private sector space where this was my task, trying to find out how this would work and trying to find that proverbial sweet spot in the middle. And ironically for me today, this is still how a lot of the sustainability language is discussed. There's a recent report from the Food and Agricultural Organization, which just came out a couple of weeks ago, describes the sustainability challenge as a social, environmental, and economic challenge, adds a political challenge to that. But from my work, I would like to argue that this has changed in how it's being argued, and it was argued this way by many others as well, but that the strength of the economy sits in the strength of the social space and the resilience of that space. And that space rests firmly in the ecological sphere. And so, just to try and use this as an example to speak maybe to one that might not be the best example, but the drought in the US at the moment, brought on by climate change, just the ecological challenge that is taking place in that space, has a consequence around a whole number of people that start to experience rapidly rising food prices, but also driven in some ways by speculation that starts to happen in the economic sphere. And so these connections start to permeate one another and impact on one another. The core question for me is how that interrelationship is then governed and what that might mean between sustainability. So to try and argue for not talking about these three distinct boxes in my private sector world, and you might know where I worked, we managed this, we developed a school, tick the social box, we provided land to a conservation project, tick that box, and the business carried on as usual, and we called ourselves sustainable. And it's really to ask for a level of critique for that and say, that model doesn't necessarily work when you try to impose it on how these are all resting one another. So the depressing part of this is to argue that we're facing what has been referred to by Zwilling and Anika and others as the polycrisis, a set of converging crises that are mutually reinforcing one another, adding sort of volume, as it were, to the challenge. These are not my choices. These have come through large global international reports. So the IPCC, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, the fourth and now shortly to come out fifth assessment report on the climate change issue, arguing for largely human-driven consequences of that. The significant ecological crisis, again, coming out in the Millennium Ecosystem Assessment, the water issues, and those have been reported widely in small sort of localized challenges, but also the global scale. So an older report from the United Nations Development Programme, which speaks of massive inequality. The UNDP report came out in about 1998. But this consequence of inequality driving a whole set of issues. And so, again, when one speaks about inequality and sustainable development, what does this kind of intersection mean? The challenge of peak oil, that we're not necessarily running out of oil, but we're using more than is available in our reserves, although they are finding more and it's more challenging and more expensive to get to some of the tar sands in Canada and things like that. But not just peak oil, but peak resources. Phosphorus is a key input in agriculture, or chemical-based agriculture and others, but also other forms of agriculture. The demographic shifts, so this move that Jane discussed into cities, but also the shifts in the power dynamics at the global level, where Europe is sort of starting to withdraw into itself, and the rise of the BRIC countries, and others wanting to be associated with that. So you have BRIC and now BRICSA, with South Africa joining that, but others as well. And these ongoing economic crises sort of reflecting a tipping point in not only just the sort of global thing, but also the economic system and asking questions around that. And then the food crisis. And all of these intersect with one another again and reinforce each other. And so whilst that might be really depressing and saying, well, what do? What excites me in the work that I do is I'd like to argue that every one of these challenges is an indicator to potential opportunities of different ways of thinking about things, different ways of understanding all these systems and how we then start to speak to those. So the question then is, what do these all have to do with cities and how cities function in sustainability? For me, this picture of Sao Paulo is reflects some of the great urban challenge that we face. That these cities, again, as Jane mentioned, whilst they are not only the Sao Paulos of the world, the large megacities, but you have this intersection between massive informality and very different ways of living to what one might imagine the cityscape to look like as a concrete jungle. And it's very different to that. It's a very different kind of jungle. Just walking through the streets of Cubero or places like that, you see a very different notion of what the city might be. And this asks us to question, really, different kinds of ways of understanding what we might do and trying to understand what the city and the food intersection might be. So really, for me, just to reiterate the points that Jane made yesterday around the second urbanization wave that is taking place largely in Africa and into these secondary cities, that this notion that we're now over 50% urbanized, and South Africa is probably just I think 59% or 60% urbanized. But also, the cities can't sort of have a general blueprint for cities. That cities are not necessarily similar. They're different trajectories in terms of development, located differently globally, which might require different responses in terms of the climatic situations that they might face. Cape Town and even Johannesburg and even Durban are very different from that point of view, and how we might understand the food systems differ. So that means that not even national decisions are necessarily valid. And then there are these different scales from the large global megacities to these rapidly emerging secondary cities of less than 500,000 people. And a number of other issues. So again, it's not the point that I would like to make, is that we'd like to try and think of cities in somewhat different ways and how these different cities, and that poses questions around where decisions about urban food systems are made and where that location might be. So the other issue is that often again, and I'll make a few points around this question of production, that the urban food question is not necessarily around just growing enough food to feed everyone, but the food question spans a vast set of different activities and sort of areas within the urban landscape, from health and nutrition to sort of public health, the safety of street foods and things like those kind of questions, the issues of sort of engagement in preserving urban land areas. And again, to use the example of Kenya, the Moy Forest, and that's the main source of charcoal for cooking, and the consequence of denuding that in the informal areas because there isn't any sufficient energy, and how that relates to the food system. Questions of land tenure, and how land might be used and access to that, and how one will then invest in inputs if you don't own the land, how all those things play out. So a very complex and sort of interconnected set of decisions around what the urban food system might be and how it might play out in terms of how we understand it and engage in it. The other challenge often when we discuss the urban food question is that we often imagine it to be a linear process. Inputs in and the sort of connections and the sort of exits the system. And whilst this might be the case, there are a vast number of intersecting points before it even gets to the sort of urban scale, wherever this might be, and then leaves the urban system as well. And so that then asks us to say, how do we then understand all these different spaces within that urban environment? And this is work by someone called Bruce Darrell that kind of reflects on a whole set of them. I've just taken one of them, for example, is the water inputs. So if you imagine sort of the production of fertilizers and inputs, be them chemical or even sometimes not necessarily always organic, but some of the sort of other inputs that come through there, the actual production, again, where agriculture consumes, is responsible consuming about 70% of the global fresh water supply, then into the various different aspects, and all that then carries into the footprint, and the same can be done for oil that might be required in that whole process, other nutrients that might go into it, labor, and a vast set of things that go into the system that drive it. And so when we try and think of the food system in this linear way, we imagine food in and food out. And I'm just going to sort of use this to try and depict some of what might happen in that particular space. So it's not necessarily just food in and food out. It's a whole set of other drivers that come into that system and then leave the system. The challenge, arguably, in cities, when we speak to this, is that cities reflect, and particularly when we speak about cities and sustainability, reflect a somewhat different trend to the other sustainability arguments. So often when one speaks about the urban and sustainability, the argument made is that cities become places of efficiency. Cities become places where one can reduce the potential impacts in terms of transport, through public transport systems if applied correctly, through energy distribution, things like that. So cities can enable certain efficiencies within that. Again, all involved in the design, the layout, some sprawl in cities like that might not necessarily do that. The challenge with food is that when we put that into the urban space and we bring a whole lot of people together, there isn't this exponential, this one-on-one kind of gradient that increases by person to the inputs and outputs. The inputs and both outputs grow significantly on a curve that increases in that way. So as a consequence of moving to cities, when one understands or tries to understand cities from a sort of sustainability point of view, cities start to have an unsustainable impact often when one looks at the food system and how the food plays. And so for me, as Gordon mentioned yesterday in the introduction, food becomes a very interesting lens to try and understand and engage in this urban challenge and the challenge of urban sustainability. Because for me, it really starts to point to a number of fault points within the city, within our structures, within how things are designed and governed, that really start to reflect where these core tensions of the sustainability drive going forward and that transition to sustainability might lie. So this question of urban sustainability, as I mentioned, has been taken up by a large number of international agencies. And at this global scale, there have been a whole set, a stream of reports that have been written about that. And really, it's about the language of decoupling and sort of greening cities and those sort of challenges. In reading all of these and trailed through about 20 different reports, only one of those reports, which was a UN Habitat report on cities in Africa, made any mention of food. So food sits outside of this space, it's not been considered. And so the consequence of this is that it doesn't attract the required funding. The link between food and health is not necessarily made and articulated in the correct way in terms of the urban environment and the lived environment. All these reports are really fantastic documents and add to the sustainability discourse, but food is conspicuously absent from this process. And if food is mentioned, it's mentioned in ways that I would like to argue don't necessarily respond to the actual lived challenge in many ways. So, interestingly enough, just before the 2008 food crisis, there were two statements made. One, someone by the name of Joachim von Braun, who was then the head of the International Food Policy Research Institute, and one can see it, but really arguing that there's a significant change in the global food system and how these changes are, and who will bear the consequence of these systems. And then Paul Roberts, who argued that, you know, the ability to feed cities is the next real policy problem. So it speaks not just to implementation and changes, but speaks to this policy question. And how is that policy being addressed when global agencies, global funders, etc., are all have this blind spot to the urban food question, and how does that impact on sustainability of the urban system? And so as part of this critique, what has happened is the large international kind of agencies have looked at the food question, but their focus has been purely on rural food insecurity and increasing the food system. The document on the far, on my far right, from the World Bank, and it was the first time in almost 25 years that they did a report on agriculture, but really advocating for a green revolution. So not a green revolution in the sustainability sense, but the green revolution followed in India with high chemical inputs, large amounts of water, and credit that comes with that, love to try and grow that. And that certainly was able to address some of the food challenges in the 60s and 70s, but a number of questions are raised about the long-term consequence of that system from an ecological point of view. And certainly in India, fault lines and some stories, and Gordon mentioned, I spent some time with some of those farmers. The middle report was a very interesting report, which spoke to taking a more South American view of agriculture, which they called an agroecological view. So looking at the broader connections of ecology and agriculture, avoiding some of the more the biodynamic and permaculture and those names, they do often have some consequence in that in terms of how people perceive what is being argued. Then we had, in, a little bit later, a report coming out from the UK government, which really drove a lot of donor funding into agriculture, calling for even more extremes. So here, genetic modification, cloning, etc., was said that this is going to be the potential way for going forward to provide enough food. So again, this question has always been about how do we produce more food to feed this growing population? The areas of production, the focus of this has been seen as being rural, but also they have these very different views of what might be required. And this has led to what I refer to as almost an agro-ideological discussions, where every different set of people who work in different spaces and align with these different reports start arguing against one another and not actually trying to find a transition through to that. And in all this space, the question of feeding cities is not really discussed. What has happened, and Jane mentioned this around the consolidation in the example of Philippi, was that, so just to remake the point around South Africa, this just reflects the size of farms and the reduction in that that has happened since 1996. And again, these are farms of over 20 hectares, so it's not the small-scale farms in those areas, there are a number of those. But the consequence of this consolidation has had another impact. And so when some of the reports call for more industrialized type farming in order to feed everyone and ignore the cities, there's an interesting consequence in that we're seeing this significant decline in labor on farms, a lot of jobs being lost. Not, I won't argue, and there's no necessarily no evidence to argue that all those people are moving to cities, but the impact on the urban dwellers in terms of remittances, all the consequences of this declining rural environment, some certainly might be moving to cities, all have consequences and all impact on the urban system. One of the examples of this is how, and through some work by another colleague of Jane and mine, Godfrey Talazera, had seen how people reduce their diet in order to save enough money to send back to the rural area because the rural areas are suffering. So the urban and the rural are definitely connected, and how those connections play out.
Is that the number of jobs?
This is the number of jobs. So this is from 2006 to 2011, looking at roughly about 460,000 jobs. Not just farm laborers, but also domestic workers and others within that. What this report doesn't reflect, and it comes from the Department of Agriculture, doesn't reflect how many of those jobs were temporary employed jobs and versus permanent jobs. So the food systems are changing dramatically, as I said. They perpetuate this polycrisis, as I described it, and highlights these connections between these two areas, and also the connections outside of the national scale into the broader scale, and how it connects into the globalized food system. And so I thought I'd just use these two pictures to reflect this. The far picture on my far right is a food vendor in Maputo, and she's selling chickens, and you can't quite read it, but it's in Portuguese, but that's because it comes from Brazil. So these are frozen chickens that are being shipped in large refrigerated ships into Brazil and being sold in Brazil. So they have sold in Maputo. And in Pemba, as the oil and natural gas is being discovered, and there's this mass of people moving to that area. So just show, again, for me, how even a vendor, street vendor, is able to connect to chickens that come all the way from Brazil in a refrigerated truck. And this is a young lecturer in Stellenbosch and his family, and this shows their weekly food. So how that food diet, and I'll speak to this in a moment in terms of the costs. But here for me, what is really interesting in the story is how it reflects not just what they're eating and the kind of what they spend, but the footprint of that food system. So the amount of packaging associated with that, the amount of processing that's associated with that, the sort of challenges that might arise in terms of diet and the selections of what they might choose, how little fresh food is in that particular basket, and this is probably one of the wealthier in the survey that we looked at. So it speaks to the story, and this is, I think some of you may have seen similar pictures by from a book called The Hungry Planet by Peter Menzel and Faith Delucio. And Peter Menzel, the young student who did this, is a photographer and got permission to replicate Peter Menzel's work, and so did this in Stellenbosch. And so I thought I'd use these to just dispute you. So you can see, and this is from 2011, the prices that are reflected there, but just to be able to see the food system and what it might look like and how different it is across a small town like Stellenbosch with about 240,000 residents, one of those sub 500,000 people cities. So you see the massive inequality that's reflected in there. Some comments yesterday, you see this particular household, nothing there besides the Masi might need to be refrigerated. And so those choices, and so possibly going to the USA for the tin goods as opposed to buying fresh food because there isn't the opportunity for refrigeration. Buying food that is unpackaged, etc. It's come from a street vendor, you wouldn't necessarily be able to buy that food, but also the issues of storage and whether they have to put ratics out to prevent rodents and things like that eating that food and what that might happen in the consequence of those sort of stories. So all of these tell the story around, you know, and Mundawak with his Bulochberg Ranavang at the back there as well. But they also reflect these different diets and the different selections and what that might mean. And again, for me, what this asks is how then does and where is the best place to start asking questions around how does one start to integrate sustainability into an urban food system and what that might be. And so one of the responses to this is saying that this sustainability in the urban space is relatively simple. We can look at urban agriculture or localize our food system. And whilst that certainly has merit and it certainly works in some of the developing world towns and that's working around that and how people can start to change that, the question for me, the two questions that it raises is in driving a local food system, who are the drivers of that change? Who create that change? What brings about that change? And is that necessarily the view of everyone in that particular space? Around urban agriculture, certainly from a policy perspective and an intervention, and to use the South African language of service delivery, if there is a problem of food issues and urban agriculture projects, do they obscure the deeper crises within the food system? Is it another form of delivery that doesn't necessarily engage in and try to interrogate some of these deeper systemic faults within the system? So these are both really admirable and necessary interventions, but they can't be the sole solution in and of themselves. So for me, the South African food system is very unsustainable. We've had this really interesting transition in South Africa where 30 years ago, the farmers that dictated the food system through the cooperatives and things like that. That shifted to being the sort of middlemen and women, you know, the sort of processing areas that started just dictating how the food system worked and what we might have eaten. You just think of Weet-Bix and things like that, how suddenly diets are shifted around, what opportunities are there. But we've gone through a third shift where our food system is being dictated largely by the retailers and the large retailers. So they're making demands on farmers and starting to perpetuate a different type of food system that we work with. And so the question around that particular issue is this particular system affordable to most of the urban residents in that transition that's taking place, in that informality? Are they even able to access that system and at what cost? The other point about that system is it generates significant wastes. And so I thought I'd just try and describe some of the urban challenges, speak to some of the issues around waste, and really try and ground this in three case studies around that. So before I ask Jane just to add some inputs around the first case study, just very recently a report has come out from the Institution of Mechanical Engineers. They don't call themselves the Institute, the Institution, so it's not a typo. But what they've done is they've disaggregated sort of at a national scale and created three topologies. One of sort of fully developed nations, one of rapidly developing nations, so the example of the China issue and that transition, and then the newly developing or kind of countries that are in the very developing stage. And at each particular place, there's a different consequence of the food system in terms of wastes. And so here in the fully developed world, significant up to 30 to 50% of waste is created from the retailer, at the retailer, and in the households. Often, in these instances, driven by the retailers calling for straight cucumbers or whatever it might be, and ignoring a number of stuff on the land and things like that. In these rapidly developing areas, it happens more at sort of in the supply chain, where there are problems around that. And then in the developing world, the challenges occur on the land and towards markets. So poor infrastructure, the lack of larger scale refrigeration and things to get food to market, the fact that everything ripens at the same time, so there's a glut of tomatoes or chilies. And so that what happens is people are earning, farmers are earning less than what they might do to, or what they might have to pay in terms of labor to harvest that. And so all these wastes, and what, when you accumulate them, or what this particular report argued, that we could create 60 to 100% more food within our system if we could just address the waste issue and the waste of food, so not the consequence later of that issue. So what I thought I'd do is ask Jane just to speak a little bit about one of the retailers and some of the work that she worked with one of her students around looking at the waste system here in Cape Town. Jane.
Right, well, good evening again, everyone. I'm just going to share a little bit of work that one of my master's students did. Maya came to me wanting to look at supermarket waste because, for her honours, she'd worked on a community gardening project and found that one of the key challenges for getting community gardens going was access to composting. Cape Town soils are not great, so it seemed low-hanging fruit from supermarkets, you know, that they're generating an awful lot of waste. Surely some of that could be deferred to these community gardening projects and would have composting. So she wanted to look at the possibility of this coming through. And it seems like a really useful way of thinking about it, because increasingly the food system is being concentrated by the supermarkets. We know the supermarkets are generating a lot of waste. We know that the waste is being separated. So it seems like an easy solution. Internationally, there's been a lot of interest in this, so we now have the food recovery hierarchy by the EPA, looks at source reduction, so reducing the amount of surplus food generated to start with, then offsetting some of the edible waste to food banks, soup kitchens, shelters, that sort of thing. What can't be fed to people goes to animals, what can't be used for animals goes to industrial uses, such as biogas digestion, ultimately down to composting, and then a final small portion goes to landfill. In fact, in Japan, and in some cities, I think San Fran, it's now illegal to send organic waste to landfill. And so there's this big push internationally for this. But what Maya found as she was getting into her research was that there seemed to be a number of structures that made this really difficult. And part of it is understanding, well, what is waste and what is food waste? You see, there's different ways of looking at this thing. Maya was looking at the potential of food waste as a resource for composting, for further food generation. And this seems to be an idea that's coming through. And if you shift the idea of thinking about waste as something to be got rid of, as something that has potential use, then you're going to change the management structures. The alternative is to think of waste as a hazard. And that's where we've been since the Industrial Revolution. Historically, there wasn't this kind of linear food system that Gareth was talking about. There was this closed cycle where all the waste from the food system was then going back into production. But with industrialization, urbanization, there's a number of fears around disease and health problems associated with waste. And so our cities have taken the decision to manage waste by putting out to landfill, washing away in sewerage. And so there's this idea of waste as a hazard. The third idea of waste is the idea of waste as a necessary evil, as part of business practice, in order to ensure your supply chain, in order to ensure good quality, you generate surplus. And so that you accept that waste is part of your system. And so this was the challenge that Maya faced. So when she was looking at where that waste goes, when she was looking at the waste, she went to a single supermarket store. We can't name the store that it was, and she asked them just to trace where their food was going. Fascinating thing was, we expected her to be able to get hard figures. Nobody in the store was actually collecting data on how much was getting wasted every day. Each sub-manager of the store was responsible for waste, but they just saw it as something to get rid of. And so different streams were going to different places. So out-of-date fruit, non-dairy containing bakery products were going to food bank, and Gareth will talk to food bank just now. And what was edible was going to charities and feeding schemes. What was deemed inedible went to animal feeders. But other streams of waste have these different paths. And so used cooking oil went back to the distribution center. Manufactured goods passed their sell-by date, like packaged foods, breads, packaged breads, frozen foods, dairy products, all went back to the manufacturers and suppliers. General waste, meat waste, all went straight to the hazardous landfill site. And so a lot of this food is just going straight to landfill. Now, most of the packaged goods are not necessarily deemed as hazardous waste. So it's not necessarily a legal compliance thing that you have to send them there. So there's an awful lot of wastage of waste. And so trying to understand why this obvious solution of using waste as an input, as a resource, isn't being done. It seems there's these systems challenges that we need to understand. So the first one, there's a gap between company rhetoric and policy and practice. So you look at what head office are saying in their sustainability reports. There's this language of closed-loop thinking. There's this language of a system. There's this language of sustainability. But when you talk to the branch managers and the people managing the subsections of the branches, there's no connect. So they say, you know, we're not allowed to let waste build up. It's store policy, and in this store we aggressively get rid of waste. It's something that's a necessary part of the business, and you just get rid of it. You don't quantify it. You recognize it's part of the cost, but it's factored in. So we need to start asking, why is surplus necessarily part of the business model? And part of that is driven by consumers. And we all know that if we go into a store and there's sort of one Philip little bun sitting in a bakery, you don't want to take that one because it's probably old. So we're overstocking to meet the consumer demand. Surplus is also potential profit. We've written in the cost of waste into the supply chain. And the costs of food waste to the company, to the environment, have not been recognized. The supermarkets are also risk-averse, and they're very concerned about the risk of contaminated food entering into the food system, which is why a lot of it ends up at the hazardous waste site. The irony is last year, it was discovered an awful lot of people are breaking into the waste site and receiving that food, so maybe if we managed it a little bit better, we wouldn't have that challenge. But it's not just a supermarket problem. It links to these wider questions about national policy, about city policy. And so there's been a shift in policy from talking about waste as something to be controlled to something that has a potential value. But some of the structures haven't yet come in place. And so you look at the definitions of waste streams. There's general waste and there's hazardous waste. It doesn't break it down into each component of that. And so because we're just separating general and hazardous, there's no way of really managing the waste as a resource. The city has been making a lot of efforts towards recycling, but it's recycling at the domestic waste stream. There's no focus on the commercial waste, which seems a strange gap to us. And then finally, there's a number of private companies who are getting involved in waste management who are very interested in things like biogas digestion and the idea of being able to feed back energy into the energy grid. But government's been so back and forth about what the conditions of selling energy to the grid are that nobody's willing to make the investment. And so it's not simply a question of technical ability. We've got umpteen technologies that could address the waste problem. It's not even simply an issue of politics, but it's about this interface between technology, politics, and the ideological shifts. And so we think there's an awful lot of potential in waste, but it still needs to be sort of harnessed. Thanks.
Thanks, Jane. So I'll come back to the food bank story in a moment, but what I just speak to a little bit is one of the other issues, and just speak to Stellenbosch again, where I did some of this work, and just show some of these issues, some of the issues that emerged from that. And in the Stellenbosch area, one imagines the landscape and the sort of broader area outside of Stellenbosch, great vineyards and things like that. And the question arose in terms of our workers, what would happen if we were to convert that land into productive food sources? And what would that mean? And there was a question raised yesterday around how much food comes into Cape Town. And so what we did in Stellenbosch was we tried to understand that, and the figures are in this broader report by Candace Kelly and Jess Schulsching, but really I wanted to show here is how this is broken down in terms of what is eaten. As you can see, 53% of what is eaten is essentially cereals and a small portion of a whole set of other aspects. But 88 odd percent of what is grown in Stellenbosch is grapes and that kind of thing. And so there is this clear disconnect. And so it seemed logical to try and say, well, how much of that could be replaced? And recognizing that that really requires somewhat different climatic conditions, although you could grow some of it, but not necessarily all of it. So there sits a challenge around this technical challenge. We said, all right, maybe that could then be supplemented with vegetables and things like that. And the real challenge when one then applies a sustainability lens to this is that what we found here is if one were to convert this to vegetables, you probably need about 3 times more water. And so in a province where we water scarce and we require, and we might be sort of running out of stored water capacity by 2017, 2019, depending on different reports out of the city, this poses a significant challenge. And so can you do that? Farmers are already transitioning away from the grape industry at the moment, and farms, and I was on one of them last week, was arguing that what happens when you do that and you try to convert to livestock and other types of things is your water use increases significantly. And so at this time of the year where Theobaldus Kloof Dam system is under stress, these farmers are starting to question some of those transitions that they took. So this diet that takes place in Stellenbosch generally reflects a whole set of other areas and other cities and things, so you see what the diet might reflect. But then the question is, who is eating and who's not eating? So again, in Stellenbosch, we were able to look and we were able to approach over 61 different faith-based, non-governmental and community-based organizations that were feeding people and feeding meals on a daily basis. And this figure reflects the sort of this side of the mountain, Winelands region, which is about 28,000 meals a day being fed, so Paar, French, etc. But in Stellenbosch alone, there was just over 9,000 meals a day being fed by these various different feeding schemes. Again, 240,000 people. Many people would imagine Stellenbosch to be quite a well-off area, not necessarily having this one. So these are those people and those who can access those meals. And I wanted to use this particular example because what it starts to reflect is you start peeling away at what this urban food system looks like, you start to see a whole different set of actors. So these non-governmental players have real knowledge about who is unable to access food, where that point might be in order to serve that food, how those networks might exist around what that food system might be and how to engage with that. And so they have significant knowledge, but are never consulted by the municipal systems, etc. One might speak to the agricultural specialists about the food question. But all these 61 NGOs, etc., that were there, there were more than 90, we got the information from 60, their understanding and knowledge is not necessarily considered to be of real importance. Another one is just the third case study that I want to speak to is the food bank. And some of you might have seen adverts for the food bank and their partnership with some of the larger retailers. For me, the food bank speaks to, it's a great story about people distributing food to a number of other organizations that might need it, but its mere existence is there because of a fault in our food system. So they are essentially, their sole purpose is to collect the surplus from the food system and distribute it to those who can't access food. So again, they are there because of our unsustainable food system, arguably. What they're able to do, just very briefly, around the food, with the work that the food bank does, is they collect generally past use-by-date food that is still fit for consumption. They then process that, they track that food with traceability, etc., and they have a network of 700 organizations that are requiring food from them on a daily basis. They're able to service about 200 of them currently. So they then distribute that food to these various different organizations. The real advantage of this is that they provide a consistent supply of food into those organizations. So when I was doing some work in Khayelitsha, there was an organization called the Olive Leaf Foundation, and all of a sudden one of the large bread companies arrived with 2 trucks of excess bread. And then they had to scramble to try and distribute that bread, and they didn't get anything for another 6 weeks. What this is able to do is create this constant flow so people can manage their food needs and it starts to assist in that. But again, there's some interesting, what they also do, they don't only collect the food from the retailers, they also purchase their own food because they realize that these organizations, they need to provide a balanced diet to them. They purchase in beans and lentils, etc., to provide various different components of what a balanced diet might be, from protein to fruits, etc., to sugars and things that might be absent from the particular diet. So what they are doing is providing this really important service, as Jane pointed, to intersecting food that might ordinarily have gone to landfill. And just the last point that I want to make around this is that some work done by the City of Cape Town through their climate change department, a gentleman by the name of Saul Rue helped with this, looked at the food footprint and the consequence of the food footprint. And his findings from this work, and then we looking at the numbers now, essentially argued that if you could divert the waste that is generated in Cape Town from that, you would actually have a better impact on the carbon footprint of Cape Town and the overall impact than changing a whole set of the embedded carbon in the food system. And so that. So really being able to be proactive in terms of waste management, there is this opportunity to have a fundamental impact on the footprint. What also emerged from that is that looking at what work is being created at this point in time from the organizations engaged in recycling and the reprocessing of that. If one looks at the waste streams, there's potential for over 5,000 more jobs to be created. So again, this opportunity to see a whole set of different issues and how one can stimulate local urban economies and a number of other potential benefits from that. And so for me, the question of sustainability in cities is how do we decouple the food system from the existing systems and how they work. And for me, this is about, often sustainability is about using less and having a lower quality of life. And that definition of a quality of life in terms of what we would define as a good life. And for me, I believe that the sustainability challenge is being able to acquire a good life, potentially even a better quality of life, but at a significantly lighter footprint and reducing that. And there are a number of programs working to achieve this. But I think what we need to do is look at how we decouple the resource consumption. So the IT age has done this in a number of large industries, but how we decouple this from economic growth and also decouple the impact, that we have a lighter impact. And the food system offers us significant opportunities to do that, and how we engage in that becomes the real question, and where that those processes and practices happen. And when we say, when I refer to we, often a question of who that we might be. And so just the last point of this is just to say, what's happening elsewhere around the world, and maybe to speak to some of the policy discussion that might happen tomorrow, is that there are a number of initiatives happening at city scale where they are actively taking charge of the food system and trying to say, how do we do this? So it's not just saying government must do this. It's about saying, what do we as an active citizenry do? How do we then engage in the food system? How do we create change? How do we acquire knowledge as a form of agency in which to create change? So we're doing the research, creating those particular that ability to do that. And when these cities have acquired this knowledge and acquired this footprint, they're able to transcend political interference. So they've been around for longer than various different political parties have moved in and out. The Brazilian example is driven by government and having huge, really, particularly in places like Belo Horizonte and things like that, having significant health impacts. But others, such as Toronto and others, some of them are driven in partnership with government, others by individual groups who then challenge government. It depends on the model, and these models are different and they vary from around the various different cities. And so the question is, where do these changes start to take place? Are we able to start acting, kind of calling for different changes in that, and what does that mean? And how does that take place where it reflects the needs of the whole city and not just an elite and select group, which is one of the challenges of some of these particular groups. And so really for me, the key drivers of the economy, as cities are this key driver of the economy and everything, they are at the vanguard of the sustainability challenge. Food offers this really interesting lens to see where some of these opportunities lie. So at this place within the food system, understanding the urban food question and urban food question in terms of sustainability is a critical question. And I don't have all the answers on how to do that. This is a work in progress and this is new work that's coming out. But hopefully we'll be able to provoke some questions and things like that, and I'll end with that there. And
when I introduced Gareth, I erroneously said, I think, that he's going to Kingston University in Canada. At a deliberate slip, I don't want Gareth to go any more than anybody else wants Gareth to go. He's a real treasure. He's going to do his PhD. He's going to finish his PhD while he's there. He's promised that he will not answer emails, so I've given you the wrong address of where he's going. I won't tell you where he's going. That was wonderful, Gareth. That was inspiring and a wonderful survey of the depth of issues that we're facing. And I think you get a handle also on how important it is, and Gareth displays it so well, how important it is to take a very broad view of the nature of the food crisis, the poly crisis that we're facing. And Gareth weaves together wonderfully in understanding of institutions and household practices and policies. You've got a pretty splendid overview. I got to thinking I should go home and rip everything that I own out of the food cupboards and take a photograph and track that over the week or the months. And that might be a little bit chilling, both because of the nature of the diet that I consume, but also the volume of biscuits that I'm going to find tucked away, that aren't doing my health any good at all. That got me to thinking, though, about what photographs would look like if one went into a restaurant and took a photograph of the food that they process, or indeed, as Jane and I were talking one day, taking a photograph of what the airlines go through and where that waste chain is. And that got me to thinking also about the potential that we have as individuals to do something about the food crisis that Gareth touched on. And I'm wondering if, you know, so much of what we might do, Gareth, actually might be a misleading step in the sense, as you put it, you know, that some of our activities might conceal deeper systemic flaws and we might be actually buying into those and concealing them. I love the idea that he spoke about waste, and the suggestion that I picked on there was that there's not a food shortage, it's about the way in which we manage food. We need to think about waste differently, and I love the notion of the wastage of waste and the value of waste. And before I open for questions, let me tell a tiny anecdote that concerns Jane, who went to a conference in Berlin and sent back a picture of her eating food at a restaurant. And the food that was being consumed at this food sustainability conference was recycled food. Let's take some questions.
Are you able to shout?
Yes, yeah, just one point. In investigating some landfill sites in Nijmegen some years ago in the Southern Cape, we came across a very enterprising farmer who ran a herd of about 20 pigs on the local landfill site in Nijmegen. So a great deal of the waste was in fact not wasted. And he had run this farm for something like 7 or 8 years and was busy with reproduction and building his farming activities with the waste of Nijmegen. Worked well.
And the other people would do that.
So we could have a landfill and rent it out by the hour.
I think so, but I wouldn't. Any journey to landfill site is quite an interesting experience. But yes, yeah. But there is opportunity. The question is, how do we get to that before it gets to the landfill? How do we work that in the system in other stages within the production cycle? So, as Jane pointed, just that last little bit, essentially, that has to go through to somewhere. It's going through to somewhere. There is this notion of there is no away. When you throw something away, it doesn't. Yeah.
May I just tell you a quick story? In Oban, years ago, we asked a porter which was the better of the two hotels. He said he'd never eaten at either, but to judge from, I keep some pigs, and to judge from the quality of the swill, that one.
So again, the food system becomes this interesting way to understand a whole set of things.
I saw a hand over there. You, sir, and then the gentleman at the back.
I'm just curious about this idea of refrigeration and fresh food sort of being synonymous. You can eat fresh food without a refrigerator. My friend calls the fridge the place where your food goes to die. But, I mean, there's a huge amount of food that does not need to be refrigerated, which we refrigerate regardless and eventually dies. But, I mean, there's a huge amount of food that doesn't need to be refrigerated. And please Google if you're not sure, but Tristan Stewart, who is a, do you know him? Yeah. So he did that experiment where he had three heads of lettuce, and he left one on the kitchen table, put one in a vase of water, and one in the fridge. And the refrigerated one and the one on the table looked the same after a week. And the one in a vase of water bit, you know, brand new, like they're just picked. So, I mean, I think, and a lot of this whole sort of new idea with food and changing the way the systems work is changing the way that we think about things. The refrigeration of fresh food should not be on the same page.
Mm-hmm. Is there a little book about what to do with what?
Google is a great book.
I'm not sure it's germane to the course, but is the restaurant industry significant in food consumption? I know several guys who act as one-off wholesalers where they take a pretty big truck to the market daily, pick up fresh stuff and distribute it to various restaurants. In some of it must be quite a significant quality of food.
And at the back, the blue shade.
I was just wondering about what are the kind of obstacles to these changes that seem to make a lot of sense and seem to be very urgent. Like the speaker has referred to that he's trying to kind of go beyond and transcend what he called echoing the ideological debate. And I was just wondering to what extent is this succeeding. What's the obstacles? Because, for example, I am co-owner of the ShopRite Checkers supermarket chain. And I'm worried already by some of these changes that you suggested.
I wish you'd known this earlier.
Yeah, I would.
I think I agree with you completely, though. Our whole perception of food and how we understand food, I think there is sometimes need in terms of how do you get food to certain areas and particular cities, or what that might mean. And so this notion of distance in different cities respond to things differently. And that example of the lettuce growing in a glass of water, and how much our food before we even get it into the household has gone through what levels of refrigeration and what levels of processing. For me, what is quite interesting, and maybe to link that to the question around restaurants, is how certain restaurants can create a fundamental shift by just making demands. So a particular restaurant that has a large footprint in South Africa, who I don't quite know where their chickens come from, that was an area that we weren't allowed to ask, questions we weren't really allowed to ask. But certainly in terms of a whole set of other processing, they said we're not going to radiate any of our produce that goes through in terms of fresh produce. And so by simply making that statement, they changed the entire supply chain in terms of steam sterilization and things like that, and created this ripple effect. So where these levers for change might be can have a fundamental impact on that. And so also into the restaurant, I think the restaurant industry has a significant impact. I think often by some of the demand, and I might contradict myself in this, I think some chefs have been very well trained to literally reuse everything. So the story of the pigs on the landfill site, you know, there's a story that the only thing you can't use of a pig is its oink. But by that level of actually understanding how to work a whole set of processes and recycle that, chefs can be very efficient. Something like Boberti is actually supposed to be the remains from the Sunday lunch, which is served on a Monday or Tuesday, that has been minced up, etc. And so these dishes have evolved traditionally to reuse a lot of waste. And in our sort of microwave packed meals, we lose all that understanding and that ability. So I do argue that I think whilst chefs certainly can do that in the restaurant industry, whether that's enabled in the restaurant industry. And I think for me, the real consequence of the restaurant industry, in a way, to answer your question again, is what I've seen in terms of how some of that industry has been dumbed down, for want of a better expression. So everything has arrived pre-washed, pre-packaged, pre-sliced, even pre-grill lines put on that. And so the consequence of that waste is happening before it gets there. And that is, there is a large proportion of waste in that particular area in that supply chain. So yes, and one of my students has actually looked at the sustainability of the Cape Town restaurant system. And her focus was not so much in understanding exactly what was going on, but was setting up a mechanism for which restaurateurs could collaborate around how to achieve sustainability. And some very interesting aspects emerged from that. In terms of the consequence of that, again, maybe a bit of that point is that whilst there are consequences from the retail system, I believe, has this great tool and almost a responsibility to drive change within the broader system and ask a whole set of questions. And those, they are seeing certain things starting to take place and certain changes and how those practices might relay into that. But Yeah, it's just how the system has evolved and how we as urban consumers have demanded and come. So it's a symbiotic relationship in terms of not to blame the supermarkets. I also would go through there and might try to purchase what I want if I can't get it from elsewhere. But these debates around, for me, the key point and what I learned from my work in the private sector in this attempt to engage in sustainability is that we might expect everyone that we engage with, and rightly so, to be a bit like the body shop when Anita Roddick was running it, where in order to run business, you externalize your value system and expect everyone to live by that. But in reality, with my work in the private sector, what I've had to learn is to take a step back from that and say, even if people are operating at a tokenistic scale and setting up sort of HR projects where the HR manager is responsible for sustainability, might have a crash, a human resource management project. Sorry, excuse my acronyms in that. What is necessary is the question for me as a sustainability practitioner is how do I accelerate that transition from that tokenistic stage to a philanthropic stage where you donate writing out a check to somewhere where it's actually embedded in business practice, where the question of sustainability becomes a lived ethos rather than something in a green report that's given to the publicist to tell everyone how green you are. And that transition is the interesting process. And I think that, for me, is another place where sustainability practitioners have this opportunity. And for me, the most important part of that is the minute the operators start doing it, they see it's not this sort of monster lurking in the shadows. It's actually quite easy, and it's something that can be done, and that can assist in that transition.
One question, two questions, three questions, four questions. Yes?
This relates more to yesterday's lecture. I've got you a card. It's vegetables in season direct from the beef, and so it cuts out most of the middlemen that you get your vegetables fresh in the packaging, and most of the money goes directly to the farmers to make food. Is this going to be something that we can do?
Yesterday and today there was a question arose about the city of the 500,000 being sort of almost an ideal of going forward. And I'd like to challenge that assumption. The work we've been doing from the engineering side, the impact of the oil industry of East Africa, what that's going to do to the structure of East Africa, and learning from what it's actually done to Angola. And I think the case of Angola has been very interesting because there we've seen quite a lot of development of the food supply system by the arrival of the supermarkets, and the supermarkets who have had difficulty in getting fresh produce of the quality that is required, have actually set up large businesses operating in Angola specifically to supply themselves. And so that's something that you haven't been talking about, is the role of the bulk purchaser of actually stimulating agriculture. And as I say, in those places like that, you certainly have done a remarkable job and created a lot of work.
Yes.
I'm not sure if you said this, but are there any cities that we're looking to that are sort of success stories? And I don't know if you kind of touched on it, but is there a certain size that is an ideal? I've read before, so it's like 500,000, but I think that's true.
Lovely notion of, you know, is there an optimal urban design which gets rid of all these food problems that we're talking about? And there was another new.
Well, decent.
With 60% of our population urbanized, surely there should be a big drive to get people back to growing their own food in their little suburban gardens, even if it's just the old door-sized plot that can feed a family.
Big car.
I'm a middle child, I'm used to trying to keep the peace always. So I think the notion of different forms of market access is a critical part, and I think we have a lot of that happening. So we have co-ops happening across the various different income groups. There are people who will save money, buy certain things at a certain time, the Stockfels, a number of those that start to work around how that might change things, but also community-supported agriculture programs where the consumers, just to explain this, consumers invest in a farm and a farmer and might actually pay that farmer in advance for 3 months' worth of vegetables. So the farmer doesn't have to go to the bank, doesn't need to get into credit, and the consumer shares the risk. and those have been working very successfully. I know a number, some similar ones coming out of Philippi and others coming out of Stellenbosch and other areas. There's some in Johannesburg as well. Other buying groups where people say, for those that do want to eat meat or something like that, they might say, fine, we're going to buy, as a group of 10 people, we'll buy half a side of beef and maybe a lamb. They decide how to cut that up, and then they distribute amongst themselves in order to access market and cut out those middlemen. So there are a number of different market mechanisms that are starting to take place. Again, across income scales, I think often the problem is those that are often understood and investigated and spoken about sit at the more middle income and upper class areas. And so how do these, the food share programs that might happen where, you know, 2 days before payday, you send your kids next door to go and play in an informal, you know, in a poorer area so that they'll get lunch and then they'll come next door. And these exchanges, so all these different food processes for me are very interesting, and they're things, again, that need to be validated and, for me, need to find agency and a voice and become acceptable in that part, in that process. To the point about cities and 500,000, I have read that these are the ideal sizes. I question that from just the geographical question. So what happens in an area, dry area with water scarcity, which is the right size in that? So I think, certainly, but I do think that, again, this notion of who drives the changes and who drives accessibility and the access to food and all that, most definitely there are a number of players who can play a role. And yeah, the supermarkets have played a critical role. You know, there are challenges around others who may, so the entry in Zambia, for example, eliminated small players. And so how is that done in a responsible way? And how is that done taking those three rings of sustainability? Is that part of your engagement process? And how does that drive it? That becomes, so yes, but there are these, certainly these definite examples of real opportunities and access. So in the sort of more North American literature and others, we hear people challenging the notion of food deserts, where people move out of the poorer areas, and so the opportunity to access food. So a lot of these retailers and food suppliers have the opportunity to provide into that system. And then just the question of, so again, ideal city size, I can't comment, but I think for me, some interesting cities, particularly in the south, is Belo Horizonte, who's looked at it, driven through Lula's Zero Hunger program, the Form Zero program from national government, and what they've implemented, and there's quite a bit written around that. There is some around issues around production, but it's not just that. It's a broader set of interventions, looking at health, looking at popular restaurants, at discounted food, subsidizing, connecting small-scale farmers on the periphery, giving them access to markets by giving them market stalls at the key traffic intersections, the prime locations, all these things that have enabled certain changes. But then in the more sort of cities, developed cities, Portland, Oregon, Toronto, Oakland, all these have got some very interesting food programs that are going across all the city. And then the issue of growing food and all that, yes, most definitely. I think, for me, it is part of something. If that is that possible in somewhere like the Cape Flats in Cape Town, for example, and what is the consequence? And for me, I'm sure there are ways around it, but one of the things that Prof. Joe Barnes raises is the water that is used in a household has often been carried very far. And so that water that is finally used for that has gone, it's been recycled two or three times. And what are the consequences? So I think when these interventions happened, they certainly had great value. What changes, what needs to be cautioned in that process? But for me, what is evident is if one speaks to some of the garden maintenance companies in more middle class Cape Town, what is seen is a lot of them are being asked to take out the rose beds and put in vegetable gardens. And what the kind of anecdotal stories around that is people are now passing the vegetables that grow through the electric fence to their neighbors and starting to speak to their neighbors again, and things like that. So there are these really interesting stories that start to happen around the food system, where it happens again. But I think, yeah, I've got my garden and my veranda and the flat that I live in, and you know, I had pesto from that for my lunch today. It is this, and there's a sense of connecting to something and playing an active role and a bit of activism in that process, regardless of where it might be. And again, I think so, depending on what you grow and how that feeds everyone is a question. Yeah.
We've come to the end of the formal allotted time. Please thank Gareth in the usual way.
Thank you.
Meeting again. again tomorrow for the third and final time. Look forward to seeing you tomorrow for the final presentation about food security issues in cities. Thank you for coming again.